This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello and welcome to what's one of the final sessions for the Festival of Ideas for this weekend. The time's gone incredibly fast. My name's Ian Gibbons and I'm sort of coordinating this bit of the program. And across with us we have Val Webb, Antonio Lacazzo, Ian McCallan and Simon Singh. And we'll talk a bit more about what they're doing as we go through. So 2009, as most of you probably know, is the 105th anniversary of the origin of the species, or give it part of its full name anyway, on the origin of the species by natural selection. And others have said previously this week, the idea for evolution when Darwin came up with his book was right for exposition. And those of you who heard Antonio's talk just previously would have seen how Darwin's idea of evolution had strong precedence, not only in biology but in geology as well. Not least of all was the work of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. And evolution itself quickly became the overarching framework for all of biology. And so by 1907, for example, Ernst Haeckel had an incredibly popular work called The Evolution of Man, which you'd buy in the cheap edition for one shilling. And despite claims from some quarters to the contrary, such as intelligent designers, we'll talk a bit about that later, the fundamentals of evolution by natural selection have continued to be supported by observation and experiment at all levels of biology, from the molecular levels right up to ecosystems levels. But over recent years, as beautifully presented by John Maddock on Friday, previously unknown molecular mechanisms have been discovered, and they've got the potential to open up maybe radical new ways by which evolution and adaptation can proceed. And Darwin's big idea has impacted on disciplines outside biology, often highly, sometimes perhaps distorted ways, such as so-called social Darwinism, which you might think is... I might think anyway, as being a somewhat mean-minded approach to socioeconomic theory to support the natural order of social inequities, one way of looking at that. However, finding evidence for the natural order, including those favouring a dominant social class, was already well-established practice before Darwin's work. Analytical and critical approaches based on some kind of reading of evolutionary theory have appeared in all sorts of surprising places recently. For example, in the emergence of so-called evolutionary literary analysis, optimistically promoted as a contribution to the new sciences of human nature. People are starting to apply in areas of humanities some of the concepts that have been well developed and well worked through in biology, and it'll be interesting to see how those things move into the future. For example, Brian Boyd has just published a book called On the Origins of Stories, a nice play, I think, on the title of Darwin's original book, and it's a wonderful book too, I should commend it. Over the last 3 days, many challenging ideas have emerged across many different domains of inquiries, and many of them raise deep questions for the future. And if we're thinking about time into the future, then surely some sort of evolutionary principles will come into play. Yet, as we also heard just before from Antonio, by its very nature, evolution in biology can't predict the future. But is it possible that we're creating a future where the influence of natural selection might not be, if at least not negated, be mollified or even coerced into our service? Is that possible? If we create increasingly intelligent machines, the artificial moral agents discussed by Colin Allen, will they be subject to natural selection? If not, will they be sufficiently integrated into our social fabric that we might also escape? Social knowledge is widely considered to be transmitted by largely non-Darwinian means, notwithstanding the ideas of memes, some of you might have heard about ideas promoted by Susan Blackburn and Richard Dawkins. These are units of knowledge which behave through society, through knowledge bases, as in a way analogous to genes. Societies, their beliefs and their values undoubtedly change over time. But can that change be considered evolution in the same way we're thinking about a physical system or a biological system? Can religious or spiritual tenets, presumably referring to some type of absolute, be considered to evolve? If so, what's evolving? The believers or simply the nature of their understanding? And what of the universe itself? It's clearly got a past. We've heard about that several times over the last few days. And hopefully there must be a future, at least in the short term. But are there optional futures, only one of which will emerge from some type of supergalactic selection process? So does natural selection work at a galactic scale, maybe? Coming back to Earth, what if we don't if we don't get climate change and the energy economy right? What if we manage to kill off all life on Earth? Could life re-evolve? Wouldn't the machines in the end win? Could they win? Alternatively, if we begin to directly alter our own genetic inheritance, can we even then beat the rigours of natural selection? So if evolution by natural selection essentially operates blind to the future, does this absolve us of any responsibility for our actions? Let natural selection decide. Scary thought. So by way of that little round of introduction, there are ideas which most have come out over the last few days as I've been listening to all the various discussions. We'll now open up the panel to give their little views on what the future might be in some sort of evolutionary point of view. We've got an incredibly eclectic mix here, and I think it's a wonderful way to finish off the session. We've got people from the sciences, humanities, and I think hopefully we'll get somewhere through all of this which will illustrate that the divide between these apparently two universes, these two domains, is actually not that big. It may not be non-existent. So first up, we're just going to work across as we're sitting here, so we've got Val Webb, who has a remarkable background. Started off as a microbiologist. She's a published artist. She's published wonderful books of sketches in historical context. She's been superintendent of communications and resources at the Wesley Hospital in Brisbane. She has a PhD in systematic theology and world religions, which is a wonderful title, I think. And she's written a whole range of books, which are available for sale out in the bookshop out there, on, I suppose, best way of summarising would be world religion. So over to Val for our first session.
Thank you very much. I think as a religious studies person on a panel on beyond evolution, I have to say something up front about the continuum of positions in science and religion. Where I stand. I'm certainly not a creationist or its retrofitted successor, intelligent design. I certainly go along with the evolutionary theory in science and also agree that the God Richard Dawkins describes in The God Delusion offers a good case for atheism. However, and that's the key word, while Dawkins simply stops at a point on the continuum with his claim that all religions are therefore dangerous and delusional, I will continue along that continuum, suggesting that Dawkins' Sunday school description of God is certainly not the only, nor even the central God idea in serious religious scholarship today. Dawkins reminds me of the astronomer who said to Karl Barth, famous theologian in the 1900s, "I have a very simple view of religion. Do unto others as you would have them do to you." Bart replied, "I have a very simple view of astronomy. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are." Any God description, whatever the religion, is metaphorical, as nobody has seen God. So to talk about a God idea in our contemporary world, it has to be in metaphorical language that is viable within contemporary scientific understanding, not over against it or opposed to it. By saying this, I'm not discussing whether God exists. The God idea can't be proven or disproved. God is a faith statement. Now, there's nothing wrong with faith statements. We make them every day about a host of topics, whether we talk about gurus, refrigerator brands, whatever it is. But we have to recognise the type of claim for what it is. Secondly, Dawkins' desire to ascribe everything, experience, creativity, altruism, wonder, the arts, simply to genes or molecular activity, or to what science can or will explain, is, in my opinion, not only a truncated, but also a rather boring way to live. I say Dawkins because he's sort of become the poster boy for those who espouse this type of approach. I'm very aware that he does not speak for all scientists. Many scientists acknowledge that there are many interesting questions about which science has little or nothing to say, and Dawkins and his ilk overstep the bounds of scientific method with claims they make about God. For what I remember from my past life when I did such things, scientific methodology demands that we plod along within the limits of our knowledge, testing the ideas we come up with for a possible evolution of knowledge. And in the meantime, we live fully with the now of our current ideas. Dawkins claimed that everything will eventually boil down to what science can demonstrate in the future is also a faith statement. Simply killing the discussion with such eschatological certainty is hardly scientific methodology and sounds surprisingly like what religion has been accused of doing with its eschatological claims. It's also, I think, a strange way to proceed in our contemporary world that recognises the relativity of knowledge and the difficulties of any universal truths. In an article by Lawrence Krauss of Arizona State University, a theoretical physicist, called "Does the Universe Have a Purpose?" and Krauss personally believes that it doesn't have a purpose, wrote, "While nothing in biology, chemistry, physics, geology, astronomy, or cosmology has ever provided direct evidence of purpose in nature, science can never unambiguously prove that there is no such purpose. As Carl Sagan said in another context, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence." Unfortunately, today, most of the discussions that include the words science, religion, and evolution in the same title assume that the discussion is between science and intelligent design. As you all know, intelligent design ultimately stands opposed to the scientific method because scientific method is based on the assumption that natural effects have natural causes and we can try and understand those causes, an assumption that is basically incompatible with their theological view of reality. Intelligent design, I think, has been pumped so large by its promoters within conservative Christianity that many ordinary people simply assume that this is the Christian response for want of other information. Intelligent design proponents have inflated a non-existent scientific controversy. In an informal survey of articles in major peer-reviewed science journals over the past 12 years, the word evolution pulled up 115,000 articles, mostly pertaining to biological evolution. The term intelligent design found only 88 articles, and 77 of these were in engineering journals, where intelligent design means something quite different. Of the other 11 articles, 8 were critical of the scientific basis for intelligent design theory, and the remaining 3 were articles in conference proceedings, not peer-reviewed journals. So Lawrence Krauss says that this is the extent of the claimed controversy in the scientific literature. When intelligent design advocates therefore respond that scientists reject their articles for journals, so they have to produce books, Krauss did a similar search of non-peer-reviewed books and articles, finding 300 on intelligent design, half of them critical. He concludes tongue-in-cheek that if 150 books and articles suggest that American schools should teach the controversy, they should also teach the alien abduction controversy, for which he got 165 hits. What concerns me, though, coming from religious studies, is that the general public, through the media, is being offered the extremes of Richard Dawkins and intelligent design as the discussion between science and faith. The topic for this panel is beyond evolution, and I certainly hope, from my perspective, that we can get beyond evolution as the assumed central issue for theology, which is certainly not so. There are so many more pertinent debates in contemporary religious studies, what with changing worldviews, interfaith dialogue, eco-theology, religious oppression, global warfare, etc. There are also many serious theologians conversant with the ongoing scientific advances who see these as exciting avenues of knowledge, not a threat. And there are also many scholars with advanced degrees in both science and theology, and many scientists with a sturdy religious faith, perhaps not with the traditional God images. As long as science remains within their defined limits of investigation, and theologians acknowledge the different methodology of their questions of meaning, both can surely explore the wonder about the universe in an open playing field. If all acknowledge the reality of uncertainty and probability in both lines of questioning and are open to the fact that neither has a hotline to ultimate truth, the game can continue. Oxford immunologist and Nobel Prize winner Sir Peter Medawar says that there is indeed a limit upon science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. I have in mind questions such as, what are we all here for? What's the point of living? From the theologians' team, Australian Anthony Campbell says that given the even more complex world we're discovering beyond science's imagining, theologians are even more able to talk metaphorically about mystery in their quest for meaning. The challenge is always, though, to allow any God idea to be big enough to be thought of in matching terms with the vastness of our universe. I'd also add that our expanding, ever-expanding knowledge of the universe actually mocks those who would promote a God that is literally counting hairs on our heads and finding miraculous parking spots for the faithful. Any such God, I think, is micromanaging. Beyond evolution, but to where? As I said earlier, I believe that Dawkins need to ascribe everything, creativity, arts, altruism, to genes, molecular activity, or what science can explain, is inadequate, truncated, and I think a sterile description of the totality of our human existence. As a theologian, I much prefer mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead's approach. According to him, it's more important that an idea be interesting than true. Interest invites adventure, whereas the repetition of true statements, whether from fundamentalists in science or religion, quickly leads to boredom and offers a very low level of beauty, one of Whitehead's criteria for life value. While truth adds a new level of interest to an idea, the ongoing adventure consists of the novel ideas that hold interest, develop, and progressively illumine dimensions of experience hitherto for little noticed, another evolutionary paradigm. Perhaps science and religion can meet for coffee today, not over the word evolution, but over the word wonder, interpreting this human experience in their own methods and metaphors. Philosopher Sam Keane said, "Historically, the notion of wonder has been closely bound up with the religious mode of being in the world. In my experience, the substance of wonder is more frequently found in the prose of the secular than in the often quaint poetry of religion. Whether we continue to talk about God is not so important as whether we retain the sense of wonder which keeps us aware that ours is a holy place." Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Val. I'm sure we'll come back to look at some of those points as we go through the discussion. But next up, we've got Antonio Lescano, who many of you would have heard speak already this weekend, because he's been speaking a lot and he's been working hard. In case you haven't heard him before, Antonio is from the National Independent University of Mexico, Mexico City, and he's the world's leading authority on the early evolution of life, where life came from, probiotic evolution. Not only is he renowned for his scientific contributions, but he's also a tireless and active presenter of science to the public. He's written lots of articles for newspapers. He's given hundreds of general public lectures, interacted with the school system, produced popular books. And as you've heard already, he's an extremely engaging teacher. As we also heard last night, he wishes he's really a chef, which I think is really wonderful. So I'll hand over to Antonio to give your view on beyond evolution, or some component of it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I have to say that it's very easy to be the world expert on early biological evolution because nobody knows nothing about early biological evolution. But I was planning to speak a little bit about time, but I cannot resist touching on some of the issues that Ball just mentioned, because she mentioned three characters that I am acquainted with, more or less, which is Lawrence Krauss, Richard Dawkins, and God. I have to say that I'm not in speaking terms with God, but have no problem with him or he, or she, whatever. But there's an anecdote that I would like to share with you because I think it's very... A couple of anecdotes I would like to share with you because I think they are very revealing. I knew that Richard Dawkins had published a book Against God or the God Delusion. And I had to transfer from one plane to the other in Houston Airport. So there's a bookstore there, and I went there and I found the book. So I got the book, went to the cashier, and gave him the book, and the cashier response was fantastic. Are you sure you want to buy this book before boarding a plane? which I think reveals the way many people think of God as someone that you should appeal to in case of danger and not as someone, whatever his or her nature is, that I'm not a religious person, you should be happy about. But that's one thing. The other point that I think is very interesting to mention is that there are a number of very strong misconceptions about what an atheist is, and they tend to be the picture as people with no morals, mean, willing to undermine the social structure. But a few months ago, I was in a meeting that was convened by Lawrence in Arizona State University, and both Richard Dawkins and me were there. And Richard is actually running a foundation to promote evolutionary studies, so he wanted to tape me speaking about the origins of life. He supports this from the royalties he gets from his books, and then distributes the information for free. And so he taped me speaking about the Miller experiment and our catalytic RNA and so on. And then he said, would you mind repeating the entire thing in Spanish so it can be provided to the poor children of Latin America? And I was amazed at the level of generosity that it implies. I would like to see some of my religious friends exhibiting the same level of generosity, namely the willingness to share knowledge. And I think this is important because you have all kind of people among the believers, you have all kind of people among the non-believers, but the one thing that's absolutely sure is that to a significant extent, many of our conceptions, scientific conceptions in the Western world, and you will see why I want to make this distinction right away, had been shaped by the Judeo-Christian tradition. Latin America is a very peculiar place because in many senses we are part of the West. In many senses we are lucky not to be part of the West. We have the extraordinary inheritance of the ancient Indian civilizations. And in the case of Mexico, for instance, the sense of time was completely different from that the Westerners, conquerors, brought into the country. Both from the Maya, the Olmecs, and the Aztecs, the sense of time that was prevalent in Mexico was a circular sense of time. The Aztecs spoke about a creation that was destroyed and then started again from nothing and then again from nothing. So you have the kind of universe, if you want to make a very forced comparison, similar to that of Sir Fred Hoyle. There was no way of keeping memory of past events. I have a number of friends that are Buddhist and believers of Buddhism. And one of the things that always surprises me is their sense of circularity of time. And it's very difficult to keep track of past events if you are going to be reincarnated over and over and over again. I'm very, very fond of the current Dalai Lama for many reasons, among others because of his struggle to keep Tibet culture and society alive from the Chinese oppression. From the oppression of the Chinese government, which is not the same as the Chinese people, of course. But I'm always amazed to realize that he sincerely believes that he is the 14th reincarnation, I think, of previous lamas. That idea of time, or the Aztec idea of time, is completely different from the Judeo-Christian conception of time, which is linear. If you go to the Sixtine Chapel, you see the wonderful depiction of the creation by Michelangelo, who was not exactly a very Christian believer. And you can see, of course, the final judgment, which is the end of time. That idea of linearity in time has played a major role in shaping our cultural prejudices for good and for bad. And in the case of science, it's absolutely clear that without that inheritance, that linear idea of time, without what happened during the Illustration, during the Enlightenment, when the idea of deep geological time was developed, not only among scientists, but also among thinkers like Voltaire, with the idea of linear time and without the idea of deep historical time and deep geological time, we wouldn't have a theory of evolution. So in that sense, I think that the interaction between science and religion in the West has been extremely fruitful for us. It's also true that I'm absolutely convinced that coming from a very secular society, as I have discovered is the case for Australia, it's very, very good to have different domains. A dialogue, but not a constructive dialogue. Because I think that one of the great inheritances that we have from the Enlightenment is precisely the fact that you can separate the idea of God from the idea of the church. You can separate the idea of nature from your religious beliefs. And I think it's the best for both of them. Whenever you hear this unpleasant touching of the divinity by dirty politicians like Mr. Bush, you feel they are soiling a wonderful idea. And I think it's good for religion to be separated from religious belief, to be separated from everyday politics, everyday science, and so on. And I would like to end with another anecdote of two characters that I have never met, but I admire enormously, which is Catherine the Great, the empress of all Russia, and Diderot, the French philosopher who was at her court. And at some point, Diderot was approached in the court by one of the popes, popes of, I don't know how you call them in English, in fact, of the Orthodox Church. And he was asked, Monsieur Diderot, I know that you don't believe in God. Can you demonstrate that this is the case? And Diderot took a piece of paper, wrote a second degree equation, say, B is equal to 2 times A a la X, and say, there is no God. And of course, the Orthodox priest had nothing to say. And he lost that argument in front of the entire court. I think that for a true believer, God should not be the God of the gaps. I think that for a true believer, you don't need to poke your finger into the wounds of Christ resurrected. I don't think that you should expect any demonstration by science that there is God or that there is no God. And I think it's wonderful to have a society in which people can be a believer and nevertheless undergo vaccination or come up with the equations that describe the expansion of the universe, and that there are others that don't believe in nothing but accept with pleasure the ethical inheritance, like solidarity, like human rights, and so on, that come from the moral teachings of different Western religions.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, Antonio. Now we move along to Ian McElman. He's currently a research professor at University of Sydney, fellow of the Royal Historical Society, fellow of the Academy of Social Science in Australia. And these are very prestigious appointments of like knighthoods in the discipline, is one way of thinking about it. He's written on a really amazing diverse range of topics in the books that he's published, History of Gold in Australia, The Last Alchemist, an Oxford Companion to British Culture in the Romantic Age. Most recently, it's in the bookshop out here now, is Darwin's A Martyr, Four Scientific Voyages to Southern Oceans and Their Fight for Evolution, which is being part of a TV series in a forthcoming exhibition for which he got an AIC grant, from my understanding of it, which is really fantastic that the government research agency is funding, bringing together these different disciplines and ways of presenting the results of research to the public. So that's a really wonderful thing too. So, Ian, what have you got to say on all this?
Thanks very much. I'm only going to speak very briefly about one aspect of Darwinism and evolution, an aspect that I don't touch on my book at all. But I just want to first begin with an anecdote, and that is that 1 month after The Origin of Species was published in November 1859, in New Zealand, a 10-year-old colony just in the bush outside Canterbury, there's a young shepherd reading Darwin's Armada. Well, he's in a shepherd's hut anyway, and he's reading The Origin of Species, if only he was reading he's reading The Origin of Species by candlelight, 1 month after it's come out in Britain. And he reads the book, and he immediately gets an idea, and he writes to a Canterbury newspaper a satirical article, called Darwin Among the Machines. And the article argues this. His name, by the way, was Samuel Butler, and his father had taught Darwin at school. His article argued this. He said, well, if humans can evolve from simple creatures into much more complex ones, and eventually their minds can evolve to the point where they achieve consciousness, why can't this happen to machines? And if it did happen to machines, what would this mean? What would happen when we evolve machines that become so complex they have something like consciousness? Will we become redundant? And he then follows this up with a kind of a book called Erewhon, which is a dystopia about a war between the machines and man, and the sort of carnage that's occurred after that. I want to, look at this as a kind of prescient moment in our history. And that is it possible that machines will take our place? Is it possible that machines can evolve consciousness? Can we become redundant in a world beyond evolution or an extension of evolution? My son is a PhD in physics and applied mathematics in a robotics centre at Sydney, and he assures me that consciousness is on the way among robots. Well, maybe that's the sort of thing your son says. looking at me as though I'm already redundant. But I have been at a conference not unlike this in the UK, and sitting in the on the same panel was a man, a professor at the University of Reading, who calls himself the cyborg. You can look him up on the web. It's Kevin Sharp is his name. He's had a whole series of operations in order to make himself a bionic man. He actually began with little robots, which he now has. He's injected them with certain kinds of organisms, so they actually are a cross between a machine and a creature. But then he inserts some tiny computers into his nervous system. He also did the same with his poor benighted wife, and produced this following experiment. She wears a necklace which glows green when he's feeling calm, but when he gets sexually excited, the necklace glows red. Imagine being married to this man. But more, as it were, I don't know, interesting, frightening, alarming than this, he has managed to connect himself to the internet. In effect, he claims he can download parts of his brain into the internet. And he sees himself as the forerunner of a new species of man. That is to say, if this can be achieved, why do we need the kind of memories we've got? Obviously, the internet's got a lot more information. It's got a lot more crap in it too, but we won't go into that. What he is, as it were, portending is a creature that is bionic as well as human. And in fact, he's saying there's going to come a time very soon when this type of creature will be superior in its abilities, in its capacities to human beings. And that when that time comes, if you haven't had your highly expensive operation that turns you into a cyborg, you're going to be a hewer of wood and a drawer of water. So beware. All I leave you with is this question. Is it possible that in our time that machines will achieve a level at which they become not simply subsidiaries of ours, but superiors? The question lies with evolution, in my view. I'll leave it at that.
Good. Thank you very much. And a final contributor, and also final contribution from him, Simon Singh, who's been also working very hard over the last few days, including this morning. Richie started off his life as a particle physicist, a PhD at Cambridge, and then he joined the BBC's science department. He was producer, director of a whole bunch of incredibly influential programs like Horizon and Earth Story. He's written books about different ideas and elements of history of science, like the code book, Fermat's Last Theorem, and most recently, The Trick or Treatment, Alternative Medicine on Trial, as you've heard about earlier today. I think the comment which is would sum up the way he's been talking over the last 3 days is fearless, intelligent, and remorselessly rational. Now, Simon's going to tell us something about the future of the universe, I believe.
Yes. I thought I'd just start with another anecdote, seeing that seems to be the fact. But I did a show at Christmas with largely rationalists or sceptics or atheists, and it was in the run-up to Christmas, and a chap called Robin Ince booked a hall of about 500, and it sold out 3 months in advance with no advertising. So he booked another night, and it was booked out 3 months in advance with no advertising. So he then booked the Apollo Hammersmith, which is the biggest venue in London, 3,000 people. It sold out, and it was fantastic to have a night of discussion of the wonder of the universe, coming back to the word you used, Val. And on the bill was Richard Dawkins. And after the show, a comedian called Stuart Lee, went up to Richard Dawkins and said, "Look, I heard you speak, and you know, you're just so clever and witty and dynamic and imaginative, and I look at you and I hear you speak, and I think there has to be a God." But I was going to talk about the evolution of the universe, just in a completely different sense, but in a sense which ultimately does come back to Darwin. Hopefully I can quickly bring us back to Darwin. If you go back 100 years, any serious astrophysicist or astronomer or cosmologist would have said the universe had just been here forever and it was going to stay here forever and nothing really changed. The odd star would be born, but then the odd star would die. But the universe did not evolve. It was just there. And that's a nice idea, because if you believe that the universe has been here forever, you don't need to worry about when it was created or how it was created or who created it. Then the idea of the Big Bang came along. And it took 50 years for the idea to be accepted. But eventually, the model of a created universe has come to be the dominant model, and there's a huge amount of evidence to back that up. Interestingly, it was developed or pioneered by a Belgian Catholic priest called Georges Lemaître, and he very much said, and people criticized him, they said, the reason you want a created universe is because creation implies a creator, and you're just trying to smuggle God into cosmology when nobody's looking. And he said, no, I'm a scientist, and if I want to study the universe, I do science. I'm a priest, and if I want to study ethics and spirituality and so on, I think about religion. And he kept the two separate. He didn't do experiments to back up his science, and he didn't do experiments to back up his faith. The two are very separate. But anyway, he came up with this idea of an evolving universe. Big bang, explosion, debris flies apart. After a few hundred thousand years, a blast of radiation emerges. What's present today is still in the universe in the form of microwaves. A few hundred thousand years later, we get to see the development of small clumps of matter, which after maybe half a billion years evolves into small galaxies. There's a satellite launched just 2 weeks ago called Planck, soon that will be sending back more data of the earliest light, this initial cosmic radiation, to tell us how the very earliest moments of the universe were and how we might have evolved from that into these nascent galaxies. And then the galaxies emerged and stars began to ignite. After a while, the stars run out of fuel and they implode and then throw all their matter apart. New stars form from that, and you get second-generation stars. They implode and throw their debris out. You then get third-generation stars. Each time the stars form and explode, you get more and more interesting elements being formed, heavier and heavier elements. I think our sun is a third-generation star, and we're made out of the components of other stars elsewhere that have exploded. The calcium in our bones, the iron in our blood, has all been created at the center of stars. As some romantic astronomers like to say, we're all made of stardust, but others say we're made of nuclear waste, but it's all the same thing. But then, where does the universe evolve from here? Well, the universe is expanding, we know that. That's what the Big Bang would predict, and that's what we see. All the universes are racing away from, all the galaxies are racing away from us. So where do we go from here? How will it evolve? Well, gravity will pull everything back. Gravity tends to pull things back together. So the universe will slow down. That's what the theory tells us. The universe must slow down because gravity pulls it back. So it could either pull it back into a big crunch. That's one option. And then maybe a big bang, a big crunch, big bang, a sort of cyclic universe is one idea. It could slow down the universe and sort of bring it to a halt. Or it might slow down the universe, but never slow it down quite enough so it doesn't keep expanding. But whatever happens, it's got to slow it down. And then 10 years ago, they sent up a satellite to measure the slowing down of the universe. Is it going to slow down to a crunch, or is it going to slow down to a halt, or is it just going to slow down to a crawling pace? What is the slowing down of the universe going to be? And when they measured it, it turned out the universe isn't slowing down. It's actually speeding up. The universe is accelerating away at an increasingly high velocity. And this is the most baffling thing in modern cosmology. You may have heard of dark mass. Dark mass is stuff out there we can't see. There's now something proposed called dark energy, which is an energy that causes the repulsion of the universe, which we don't really know what it is yet. But it's real, it's there, and it's likely that our universe will expand at an ever-increasing rate. The matter will get more and more spread out, and we'll end up with a universe that's cold and largely empty because the energy and mass has been so spread out. So that's the evolution of the current universe. Now, there's nothing Darwinian in that, because it's just change. I'm not saying how that change is happening. Well, it's happening according to the laws of physics. But if we go back to before the Big Bang, we can then start thinking about ideas of Darwinian evolution. Because that's, you know, the next question is, if the Big Bang really did happen, and we really think it did, what came before the Big Bang? Well, one idea is that our universe can give birth to another universe. And our universe would have been born out of a previous universe. So you have mother universes and daughter universes and granddaughter universes and so on. And you have an infinite family of universes, of multiverses. And now, this is possible. It's highly speculative, and people are looking for the evidence of how we might prove this. But it's a very appealing theory. Because if you have this infinite branching tree of universes, of universes being born out of other universes, each universe will be slightly different from its parent. Now, that's interesting because you then have a whole variety of universes. Some of them will be sterile. Some of them will be born in a fraction of a second and collapse in a fraction of a second. Some of them will be just like us, just like our universe. And this is important because it might explain why we have life in our universe. Life is incredibly special and precious because you need a remarkable set of circumstances for life to evolve. If, for example, gravity were different in our universe, if gravity was too strong, those stars I talked about would form and then collapse so quickly that life couldn't evolve. If gravity was too weak, then the stars wouldn't form in the first place. So how can we live in a universe where the gravity is just right for life, and the electromagnetic force is just right for life, and the nuclear force is just right for life? Well, the reason is that there are an infinite number of universes, most of them are sterile, but we happen to be in one that just seems to be just right for life. So that's how we can start to begin to invoke ideas of Darwin within the notion of cosmology. And that's one of the answers to the question of what came before the Big Bang. I'll leave you very briefly with another answer of what came before the Big Bang. I often get asked that question when I give a talk, and the answer I give is an answer that was given by St. Augustine. When he was asked the parallel question in theological terms, the parallel question is not what came before the Big Bang, but what was God doing before he created the universe? And St. Augustine became so frustrated to this person that would ask him this question, he said he was creating hell for people who ask questions like you. So I'll leave it there.
Good, terrific. Well, I've got pages of questions here which I thought of in advance, but a lot of them have been superseded already. But I might just follow up on some of those comments that Simon was saying then about alternative universes. And Rachel Webster the other day was talking about the notion that even in our current universe, that the amount of dark matter and dark energy in our current universe probably outweighs, in some sort of way, some sort of sense, the sort of matter that we're made out of. And that most of the universe isn't us, is one simple way of paraphrasing it. And I suppose the question then, to go back to the other members of the panel perhaps, is if you're looking at the notion of, on one hand, some higher spiritual plane that perhaps people might aspire to in some religious sense, maybe that's not the right way of putting it, if you're looking at the sorts of conditions that have led to the prebiotic evolution of life, if you're looking at the difference between something living and something's not, between a biological system and a machine-based system, if you can have alternative universes, or even within our own universe, if there's another whole way of doing things, where does it leave our current ideas on these matters? Maybe you want to quickly run across. Maybe it's a non-question. We should feel free to say that too.
Well, actually, can I just jump back to your comment about these universes? That was really interesting to explore in terms of Hindu, the idea of Hindu understanding of the recreation of the universe and the times between the universe and the recreation. I'm not suggesting that, you know, this is my explanation, but I think it's interesting when you get these sorts of ideas that have come up as human struggling with ideas. Obviously, this is coming from a scientific perspective, but it's interesting that ancient peoples also have some of those thinking. As human beings, we've obviously got to think in metaphors, because you're doing some speculation there from our current knowledge.
Yeah, I think it would be more shocking if no society in the whole of history had ever come up with the idea of a cyclic universe. Mm-hmm. To me, that would be utterly shocking. Mm-hmm. So I just think that almost everything in science ends up with a metaphor or a parallel in some religion or in some society. And then the danger is that people do latch onto that, mm-hmm. and say, well, you know, we told you so. And I know that's not what you're saying, but I get lots of emails like that. and even within science, you end up with ideas that that have been, you know, speculated before. So I was having lunch with somebody today talking about global warming, and apparently Charles Babbage, over 100 years, 150 years ago, proposed the idea of global warming based on the idea of increased carbon from probably all the industrial revolution that was going on around him. But it wasn't really based on anything meaningful or scientific or serious. It was wildly speculative. And he probably said 10 other things that were wildly speculative, and that's one where he happened to strike lucky. So I kind of like Georges Lemaître's idea of just keeping them separate, mm-hmm. science and religion, the mutual sort of respect.
Mm-hmm. But you raised there the inherent in a lot of the way we think about different aspects of science is the dominant metaphors of the time, which often reflect the dominant technology. the latest technology of the day. So my area of neuroscience, the operation of neurons in the brain and muscles has been variously thought of as being hydraulic, steam-powered, some strange electrical fluid, radio waves or something like that. And these days, computer analogies are commonly made, and they will break down and evolve with time.
I think, too, the on that metaphor idea, that it was interesting listening to some of the sessions the last two nights to hear the metaphors. You know, the idea of mystery, the metaphor of leap of faith, articles of faith, sacred cows. Oh, these all sort of came up, intuition, serendipity. It's interesting how many of our metaphors to explain our scientific approach have been borrowed from our culture, which is so inherently, you know, based on religious ideas in its earlier times. I'm not making the argument that to put the two together. I'm just saying as human beings, we have to get our metaphors from somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's just very interesting to see how these metaphors do come from previous religious understandings or words.
Antonio?
It's true what you're saying, but it's also true that that can vary from society to society. For instance, one thing that impresses me enormously is the role that religion plays in American society. And I can quote a number of books in which, for instance, the earth is compared to the Ark of Noah. And saying that, okay, if something's going to happen to the earth, microbes will survive because the meek will inherit the earth, and they are traveling in an ark of Noah and so on, which is a kind of metaphor that you will never find among the French or among the Mexicans. We really don't subscribe those very religiously oriented metaphors. But there's one thing that I wanted to mention that shifts the conversation a little bit to a different issue and relates to what you were mentioning about creationism. Simon just described beautifully, I think, how Darwinian thought has influenced cosmology. And you can find the same, for instance, now in combinatorial chemistry, which is a field that for many years was kept apart from Darwinism. But what it's a pity is that we biologists have not interacted more with physicians, with veterinarians, with agricultural scientists, in a way that people who want to be medics or want to be veterinarians actually know sufficiently about Darwinian evolution. And the same is true among biologists. In biology, you hardly ever, if you study biology, you hardly ever have see the human being as a biological entity. You may learn about physiology, you may learn about anatomy, but not biologists really don't get that mix of anthropology, medical anthropology, and so on. And I think that if we really want to reinforce strongly the idea of evolution as a way of limiting the spread of creationism, we might as well try to rethink our the way we teach life sciences in general to make people understand that the theory of evolution is the central theory of all life sciences. It's a pity that it's influencing cosmology and not medical studies, for instance. It's true that we have evolutionary medicine, but the curriculum seems so full for the medical students, they really don't get the chance to learn about evolutionary biology as such. And I think it's an area that we should pay more attention to.
Yep, Ian.
Well, I actually would just like to bounce it back to the audience. I look around and I see lots of very, very interesting people. And I'd like to hear what the audience thinks about the ideas we've been tossing around.
You're right on time. So that was going to be my next shift. So we could talk amongst ourselves for a long, long time here, as I'm sure we could. But we've got a couple of microphones. There's one up the top up there, and there's one in the middle here. And if you've got some questions you'd like to throw to the panel that on anything that we've talked about, or maybe something we haven't quite touched on you think that we ought to, then now's your chance. We've got plenty of time, but please keep your... There's a lot of people lining up. Keep your questions, comments brief. It'd be great. Thank you. We'll start down the front here.
Thank you for your contributions. I have a query about the a priori acceptance that that discussion on science and religion are separate. In relation to that, I want to ask the question, what do you think an idea is, as we're in the Festival of Ideas?
Who'd like to go first?
You haven't spoken that much.
For me?
Yeah, you invited the question.
I'm not going to be able to give you a definition of what an idea is, but I think it is a, you know, all we do is we say use other kind of words to describe it, a conception, a way of grasping something. All I do know, or I think I know, is that ideas are susceptible to evolution as well. They can become more complex, they can devolve, they can die like exploded, poor old exploded planets. And so in that sense, I mean, I don't know whether the questioner is interested in that particular conception, that is, are ideas are as susceptible as has been argued, like memes, do they evolve, are they subject to natural selection, to sexual selection, and other kinds of processes like that?
I think it's as far as we'll get for now. next question.
Yeah. Val, you mentioned that Dawkins sort of leaves the concept of God at a point where a theologian would go on and say it's a metaphor, but something that Antonio brought up was that in America this sort of thing, ideas, it would be a bit alien to Australia and the UK, but in America, to say that God would be a metaphor, as theologians would be alien to the very people who are believers, to a large proportion of them. There seems to be a bit of a gap between what people on the ground believe and what we, who are more familiar with ideas, have conceptions of. How do we get between the ideas that we have and what people on the ground have as ideas about things like evolution and religion?
I think that's interesting, and I think you mentioned the same thing here about the how do you get the ordinary public or the general public to have access to some of the things that we discuss here. And that's a huge question in theology as well. And, the recent book, I shouldn't push my book, but the recent book is on how humans have tried to describe God across religions, and the theme there being that we are talking in metaphorical language. You know, I think this is something that you talk about the American conservative Christian tradition, perhaps. There's not really that understanding of metaphor. In fact, in the Christian tradition, we have moved historically from what the Jewish rabbis and early church fathers certainly understood as metaphor in talking about God. To by the time we get to the Middle Ages, we have a trinity of three men, pretty much three persons, and therefore all you talk about God has to, or at least it's two men and a bird, it's not actually three men, according to the art and literature. So all your discussion then has to become in terms of human characteristics. And I think if we are going to talk about any sort of divine idea at all, we have to get back to what is actually universal across religions, and that's the idea of formlessness or some energy or some way to talk about the divine. Now, this doesn't mean we have to then, it's not the God of the gaps, because if you're going to talk about anything like that, you have to get it, talk about it fully within any universe discussion. And as I say before, this comes down to a faith statement. It's as simple as that. I heard somebody talking the other night that could said a whole description in terms of God language, and all I could think was, you know, you could say that whole thing from the point of view of just natural procedures. And so I think you're what you do metaphorically, or whether or not you want to include a God shape in your worldview or not. And that is a faith statement, and I think then we can talk together, because it is a faith statement if people want to go in that direction.
And it's just general, can I just say, metaphors are nothing to be ashamed of. That's natural selection was a metaphor. Darwin was very conscious that he was using a metaphor in order to make clear something that's extremely complex. We need them and they are powerful tools for science and for theology and for every other form of thought.
Can I just generalise the question just a smidge before we go on to the next one? In that, we've got four expert communicators of specialist knowledge out to the rest of the world. You've all published widely books that take your expert knowledge and present it in a way that's accessible to people who don't have access to that primary knowledge. So how do you go about deciding, what do you think the key questions are that you're going to go for your next project? I mean, what drives the process of deciding, well, this seems to be something the public really needs to know or ought to know or should know, or is this just something I'm being asked all the time? I mean, how do you make those decisions?
Well, I've probably got the freest rein in that I'm not a specialist like my other colleagues here. So, or Richard Dawkins has devoted his whole life to evolution, and somehow that's going to be part of the next book he writes. I can sort of pick anything, and it's kind of haphazard. It's just I wrote about cosmology because I was sat next to somebody on a plane and they didn't know really what the Big Bang was, or they didn't know that it was a really solid scientific idea. And I thought, we're the first generation of humans to have a theory of the universe that's reasonable and reliable and beautiful and elegant and verifiable, and that this person really ought to know about it. And so I sort of think that was a reason for writing the book. Or sometimes I think I made that story up. And I'm now never quite sure.
And Shana, do you...
Well, I can put an example. When we were faced a couple of months ago with the appearance of the swine flu epidemic, I think the government, I strongly dislike the current government in Mexico. It's a right-wing government that confuses a sense of a statehood with administering a bakery in a small town. There is a right that I have a tremendous respect for, which is the French right. I'm not speaking of Le Pen and these kind of people, but think of Raymond Aron, who was a very sophisticated intellectual that had an idea of what culture should be and so on, from a perspective that I don't agree with, but this is not the case of the current Mexican government. And nevertheless, they did something quite proper, which was to take a number of measures like closing schools and so on in order to prevent the epidemic from becoming... From getting more ill people, more infected people. And then I was in the middle of organizing in my university all the activities for celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species, and I said, this is impeccable. I mean, if I can quote Cromwell, the Lord has delivered the virus into my hands. And all of a sudden, I put together a number of friends and colleagues, and we decided it was an impeccable opportunity to introduce the idea of evolution in a way that everybody knew what we were talking about. And I think it was very useful, and I think the people appreciated it enormously. And I have to say that at a point, I was in a television program with two friends of mine, and we had to convey the idea of reassortment of genes, as in the case of influenza virus, which, as you know, have 8 different genes and they can reassort themselves and so on. So we took dominoes, is that how you call them?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Dominoes, and we mixed them in the table in front of the cameras, and the people got the idea without any problem. But then, playing with that idea, I went back to some of my colleagues and said, look, we should not think about the influenza virus in general as a single biological entity, but rather as a space where you have gene swapping processes. And now we are writing an article about that, a scientific paper about that. So I think it's a wonderful case of being very opportunistic, as evolution is, and then profiting from the fact that we had a new disease, promoting the idea among the people of Darwin and so on, and then using something that was developed for the entire public as the basis for a scientific paper. Yeah,
fantastic.
But I think that happens all the time to all scientists.
Yep. Well, give an example, the recent book I wrote, Darwin's Armada, which is about four people, arose because I had got interested in ecology. I mean, ecology seems to be the issue of our time. And you can't help it. You can't. You take it in through the pores. So starting to look at the history of ecology, and I find when I do that, that three of the most significant early exponents of ecology, Alfred Russel Wallace, Joseph Hooker, mm-hmm. in terms of botany, and Charles Darwin, all voyaged to this country and formed their mm-hmm. science on voyages here. So that becomes the basis for a book. But it was not what I expected to find. Mm-hmm. It arises out of your concern with the issues of the present and the future, and I'm sure that influences what historians then address in the past.
Terrific, thank you. We have a question at the top there.
Thank you. This discussion reminds me a bit of that old joke, what do you get when you cross an agnostic, a dyslexic and an insomniac? Someone who stays awake all night wondering if there really is a dog. My question is about evolution. We think about evolution in terms of the life forms that we know, human beings and other life forms on our planet. Do you think if the universes out there are expanding and evolving, is it likely that there are other life forms around? Is Doctor Who right, or is it all a bunch of rubbish?
Simon or Tony?
I think just in terms of a numbers game, I think you probably don't even need other universes. I think our galaxy has maybe 10 billion stars, and there are 10 billion galaxies in the visible universe. So that's billions upon billions of possibilities. I think roughly half the stars are in binary combinations and are orbiting each other, which is so unstable that you won't have life in them. So you could get rid of those completely. You could maybe get rid of half the stars because they're too young, another 20% of stars because they're too old, and so on. You can begin to... But you start with such a huge number of a billion possibilities. And there's something called the Drake equation. And the Drake equation tries to work out what the probability is, or the number of life-sustaining planets in the system. And it's hard to pin down the variables in that equation, but I think most astronomers who are interested in this area would say it's almost inevitable that there's life. But it's one of those... Whatever the answer to the question, it's fantastic. If there is life out there, it's amazing. If there isn't life out there and we're it, that's amazing too. So either way.
Antonio?
Well, it's I would just like to mention a brief anecdote. A very dear friend of mine, Lynn Margulis, who's a very distinguished evolutionist, once was invited when the Viking missions landed on Mars to give a popular lecture about Martian life. So she decided to actually show a number of very peculiar life forms, and the people were absolutely convinced that they were Martians detected by the spacecrafts. And towards the end she said, okay, everything I show you are microbes, are proteins on our Earth. So I think that shows how little we know about life on the Earth itself. And but at the same time, the chemistry, whatever diverse the forms are, is basically the same. And we do live in an organic universe in the sense that the most complex molecules we see are organics. We do live in a universe that, I don't want to make a very strong statement, but there's a certain chemical determinism, the kind of molecules you can form. Amino acids are very easily formed, nucleobases are very easily formed, so I wouldn't be surprised if the chemistry is basically the same. Nevertheless, keep in mind, I'm sure you saw E.T., that famous movie with the creature that lands on the Earth, whatever. At some point, she is taken into the surgery room, and the physicians come out and say, it has DNA, it has proteins, but they never say if the amino acids are left-handed or right-handed. And that will be an issue to discover.
Fantastic. Okay, next question, please.
I know it's a very speculative question, but if we humans evolve into coming decades and centuries with a combination of things like cybernetics and nanotechnology and the other fields available to us, what would our morality, our philosophy, our religion be like? Would there be things that would be very much the same? Would there be things that would be clearly different?
I think that goes to the comparative theologist, doesn't it?
I think when we get to morality and ethics, I think we're dealing with things that I don't think there's any universal ideas. There's not, you know, people argue that there are universal morals, universal ethics. You know, thou shalt not kill. Is that a universal ethic? I'm not sure it is. Certainly for people, Jains will include things that you must not kill the gnat that gets into your nose. You have Christians who will say you must not kill the fetus, but are quite happy to send criminals to capital punishment. You have the Hebrew scriptures, that's where it comes from, thou shalt not kill, and yet you probably have more wars and killing in the Hebrew Bible than you have in most places. So, you know, I don't think morality and ethics are as universal, and maybe others might disagree with me, as we have in the past tried to make out to be. I think in any context, any time, any circumstances, our ideas of what is right and wrong evolve. Oh, that was the right word, wasn't it?
Yes.
Evolve by taking in the currents of the knowledge and the conflict. I mean, you think, look at things like what's happened to women, you know, many, many centuries ago. And we've evolved beyond that, where we will now challenge the treatment of women. So it takes a lot of things in the moment, our knowledge, our situation, to create what our morals and ethics are at that time. So I would see that this is going to be another evolutionary thing, depending on our understanding at a future time as well. Maybe somebody else has a more universal understanding of ethics.
Ian, as an historian,
is that my character, the cyborg, if being a complex creature like a cyborg leads to you putting necklaces around the neck of your wife so that they glow red and green, there's clearly a vast gulf between the complexity of technology, even of biology, and morality. Our cyborg is claiming that the future cyborgs will become a kind of super race. Well, where have we heard that before? So my suspicion is that if there is an evolution of morals, it's on a very different pace, rather like Antonio was saying. It operates in a very different pace to the evolution of machines or biological entities.
Do you think, just building that for a moment, do you think that the sorts of issues which are emerging out of molecular biology, with the ability to modulate and modify development, certainly in animals, potentially in humans, is that likely to impinge on the moral and ethics debate? Quite apart from the ethics of doing it in the first place, having got transgenic people, for example, how would that change ethics and the way we deal with each other?
I think that the real issue, and I mentioned this the other evening, is that our legal, our ethical, our social, our economical systems have to cope with problems that had never been faced before. Think about the issue of genetic modified foods. Mm-hmm. It's a very hot issue in first world countries, like Australia, like Europe. Is not an issue for many African countries. But the real problem is there, do we have the right to patent those organisms? Our patent laws come from the 19th century. Mm. Think of some of our ethical values. Is it legal to dig a hole in someone's throat so he or she can live to a tracheotomy? Remember that vaccination was at first forbidden by the Catholic Church. So it's just that we are facing, life sciences especially, are just opening a wide range of problems, unsuspected problems, with techniques that are already available that we would have never expected. DALL-E wasn't planned. It was the outcome of molecular biology techniques that were already there. Mm. And it came as a big slap on the face for most of our existing framework of values.
Simon, have any comment?
No.
Okay, good. Okay. Next question, thank you.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about religion in America, where in America you have both an increasing number of atheists, over 10%, and an increasing number of creationists, fundamentalists, over 50%. So it seems that, you know, what used to be the fringe fundamentalists are now becoming the mainstream, people like Falwell and Robinson, and people like Bishop Sprong are sort of now becoming the fringe in the nation with, you know, the most scientifically advanced nation. Would you comment?
I think statistics about religion are always very difficult because it depends the questions you ask people. And I think a lot of the American statistics, you might ask people, do you believe in a God? And people are going to sort of register according to their particular image of what they see God to be. It's not specific questions you're asking them. Or you might ask a question that says, do you believe in a God that and a Jesus that saves you and so forth and so on. And so often your statistics are a little skewed in terms of what people are actually thinking, because it doesn't give you that variety to be able to pin yourself in the moment or the particular place that you might want to be. Certainly, fundamentalist Christianity is very strong in the States. I think you've also got to understand, and I noticed having lived in the States for 30 years, the huge difference between Australian thinking and American thinking in terms of their own identity. We're sort of the same stock, but people went to America as God's chosen people, the new Israel. As they got off the boat, they have the most eloquent lectures given to them about how they will now be the light upon the hill for the whole world. And so that is in their psyche from the beginning. What happened to Australia?
Someone else's chosen people.
Exactly. And a God-forsaken people. And the other question we don't think about out of Victorian England, but earlier in the 1700s, is the idea that God only travelled with the good, the rich in Britain. And so it was a big question when the convicts came to Australia, did God come with them? Or did God stay where God's place was, you know, with the good ones in Britain? And so you have this whole different mentality in terms of God. And I think what happened in Australia, the other aspect is that the guards for the convicts were also very good Protestants and religious people. And so God was with that layer of society, but not with the other layer of society. And so I think the mateship that does develop in Australian thought has a lot to do with God is not here with us, we've got to survive, and so we're going to have to help each other. So I without going into a whole analysis of it, I think there is certainly a God idea within the American psyche that even people who might move beyond that, you know, will still realise it's part of the heritage.
Interesting. Antonio?
Yes, I remember I was watching in the television the debate between the pre-candidates of the Republican Party, and not one of them was willing to declare himself an unbeliever. And most of them, 80% of them, actually say that they supported the idea of creationism in schools and so on. On the other hand, I remember when I first heard Mr. Obama as a candidate speaking, I tend to like him, of course, but then I felt sort of bored because I thought that he was preaching and instead of speaking. And then I realized, of course he's preaching, but that's for a very simple reason. The black churches in the United States had people like Martin Luther King, had people like Reverend Jackson. They were instrumental in assessing the human rights and equality for the black people. So you also have that component in American religion as a sociologic, as a social phenomena. And it's also true that in the 70s, the American churches these very religious people also promoted very strongly the World Council of Churches, which was instrumental in saving a huge number of political prisoners from Latin America, African, and Asiatic countries. So you also have this component, which is interesting. I mean, but it's too religious for my taste.
I think it's also true that quite a number of Americans in the Midwest and in the South identify anti-Darwinism or anti-evolution with their position as Southerners or Midwesterners. Yeah. That is, they identify against the pointy heads in the North. And it's more complex than their actual religious positions. It's a kind of identity issue. And so, you know, we're proud to be rednecks means we're proud to be anti-Darwin. They probably don't even know what Darwin said.
I mean, I was going to sympathise with Val's position about whether these statistics really bear out, because it'd be interesting how many Americans, you know, do go to church every Sunday. You know, do they really have a commitment to God, or is it something more vague than that? And I'm not sure I really believe these 50% numbers, but then when Antonia says that 80% of the candidates were strongly anti-evolutionists, it reminds me that actually there may be something to these statistics after all.
Okay, thank you. And we've got time for one last question, maybe two. Here we go. We're nearly finished.
Evolution at the moment is a really popular concept and is used to explain things in a range of fields. I just wondered if you think the dominance of the evolutionary paradigm is stifling intellectual creativity or the opposite.
Simon, where to go?
Yeah, well, I think it just pops up where it's useful and where it's not useful. I mean, we're talking about what's an idea to start with, and one definition might be something, you know, a good idea is something that's useful. So in terms of computer science, when computer scientists wanted to teach their computers to play chess, they'd have to program them really painfully about the rules and the strategy and allow them then to go out and explore different opportunities and see which strategy might work better than another strategy. But it was a really long and painful technique. But when it came to checkers, was it checkers? No, it was backgammon. A team at IBM did something really clever. They got a computer, and they just taught it the rules of backgammon. And they got another computer, and they gave it the same set of rules for backgammon. And then they just played each other. And they would generate daughter programs, and they would play the daughter programs against each other, and the winning programs would again play against the granddaughter programs. And eventually they evolved a perfectly, by selection of the fittest, they evolved an absolutely perfect backgammon playing computer, one that could never be beaten in the long run by a human. And so taking Darwinism there and employing it in computer programming proved to be very, very powerful and effective. So I think, where it's useful, it'll thrive, and where selection of the fittest of the theory of evolution across science in general, perhaps.
I think it's worth saying, too, that Darwin himself believed in three different versions of evolution. I mean, he believed in sexual selection, natural selection, and also, in his latter days, also in Lamarckian evolution. So it's not one thing. It's actually a very complex number of different versions of evolution that occur, even in Darwin's time. And I don't believe it is a stifling to creativity, partly for that reason. There are varieties of evolution. As you say, they can be applied to different kinds of conceptions. They pop up here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, Mike, in interest of getting everybody through, next question.
I believe there's a part of the brain called the amygdala, which, when stimulated, creates visions of heavenly hosts, angels and the like. And I am just wondering, if every part of us has evolved for a reason, what the amygdala is for? Is it proving the existence of God?
Well, I'm a neuroscientist. If I could answer that question, boy, or dead for another hour.
I would be willing to stimulate my amygdala to see if I can levitate or something of the sort. But
it's a bit more to it than that. But it's an important question, and people can under certain types of brain stimulation, people report experiences which they say are similar to some sort of spiritual experience, perhaps rather than religious experience, some sort of verge onto out-of-body experiences. Now, the question then is, which we won't have time to discuss now, but does that mean that all spiritual experience is generated endogenously, just by thinking about it, appropriate stimuli? Or, and maybe not exclusively, if you're a religious person, a spiritual person, does it mean that that parts of your brain are being activated by something bigger and better out there? I personally believe the former, but it's consistent with the second view as well. Anyway, last question, I think.
Indeed, whatever happened, it looked like our brain is full of wonder, and all the members of the panel show that, and science is full of wonder. And you mentioned, Val, that wonder is the basis of religion. My question really is, tongue-in-cheek, why do we need then, if wonder is permeating all of us, why do we need specialists in the name of theologists and priests?
Well, as somebody who's not a priest, no, I think it's interesting if we look at the nature of religion itself, that we, if you want to take Houston Smith's characteristics of religion, you have authorities, you have rituals, you have speculation, you enter traditions, you have a concept of a divinity, and you have some sort of concept of mystery. And so I think right through time, people have had the experience of wonder and awe at the universe, but there's something about us that seems to want to move it from that experience to do something with it. And once you start doing something with it, then you need to you move into your traditions, into your reasons. I would think that I see a lot of movement today, certainly way out of organized religion, particularly people who might have been in religion, because for that very reason that I think we can wonder and have awe, and we can. And the other thing is too that there are more books in the popular marketplace now. I think in religious traditions we have for many, many centuries been told what to believe. And now we suddenly have a whole plethora of books in the marketplace, both in science and in religion and all sorts of other things, that allow people to think for themselves and give them some sort of source beyond the institutional church. And so I think we have this struggle now between institutional religion trying to shore itself up and often becoming even more authoritative because of this leakage out of religion.
Okay, thank you. So we're almost out of time, so maybe one final comment from each of the rest of you. Antonio?
When she was describing the rituals of the church, what came to mind is the Orthodox and the Catholic churches that have very elaborate rituals. And what came to mind in my case in Italy was the famous phrase by Jean Cocteau, the French author and movie director, this polymath, extraordinary polymath, that staged a number of extraordinary movies, The Beauty and the Beast, for instance, which is amazingly beautiful visually. And once he was asked did he have any religious doubts, and say, I have no religion at all, but I'm very grateful for what I learned in going to Mass every Sunday. All the rituals that I saw inspired me to become a theater man. Yeah. And it's true. I mean, that happened, for instance, when the Catholic priest went to America and faced for the first time the Indians. They were amazed and liked the thing, and they began mixing the old deities with the new ones. And it's part of the culture. And that's it, period.
Yeah. Ian?
I'd just like to, I suppose, tell a story about Charles Darwin. And that is, as he was writing The Origin of Species, he was extremely sick and really very miserable about nature. As his disciple T.H. Huxley once said, if you listen to put your ear to the ground, all you hear is one long scream of pain. And that was really the predominant view, natural selection, that was in Darwin's mind as he's trying to, very, very ill, writing this book. So ill, in fact, that he went to a health farm at Moor Park in England and just tried to recuperate in the last moments before the book was published. And in this kind of miserable state of mind, he goes to sleep in the grass
and he wakes up for the first time in a year or more. He suddenly feels wonderful. And he looks around at nature. Instead of seeing it as bleak and ugly, he sees it as enlightening, inspiring. That is true in nature. Both it's red in tooth and claw, and it is also can be wondrous and exciting. I think we don't need more than that.
Simon, your last comments?
Yeah, I was interested at the very beginning. We sort of put intelligent design to one side and sort of moved on very rapidly away from that. And Antonio mentioned the idea of if we're going to teach intelligent design in schools, then we should teach alien abduction schools as well. And it shows the absurdity of it. And it reminded me of a chap, a young American student, college guy. I've forgotten his name. You may remember him. He wrote to his local school board because he was incensed that they were teaching intelligent design. And he said, look, here's my theory. That the universe was created by the flying spaghetti monster. And I demand... Do you remember the guy's name? It's a beautiful parody, and he demanded that they teach it. And when they wouldn't teach it, he wrote a whole book about it, about what he called Pastafarianism. and he tried to explain how, the absurdities in thinking more generally. He then went on to explain that he thought the cause of global warming was a shortage of pirates. Because if you plot a graph of the Earth's temperature, it increases with time, and the number of pirates decreases with time. Obviously, there's been a boost recently in the number of pirates. But he points out that every October, on October the 31st, you see a lot of people dressing up in pirates as they go to Halloween parties. And in the months that follow, the temperature does decrease. So,
So thank you, Simon. That was a wonderful way to finish up with a set of stories in response to a question. I'd like finishing up there with a slight sense of absurdity too, because I mean I like that personally, and I think it's all we've got to take all this stuff seriously, but you can take it too seriously too. And I think we've seen today that a bunch of people who serious about their work have also got a generosity of spirit and a generosity of humour that they've shared with each other and with us. And so thank you very much for that. But just before you all go, I've just got a couple of other things to say. This is the last session for this Festival of Ideas, and What a weekend it's been. I think this session has in many ways epitomised many of the great things about it. Before we came in here, we had no idea really what we were going to say, how the session was going to go. Four people from all around the world on all different domains getting together and talking about something which turned into, I think, a really wonderful discussion. But that's what the whole weekend's been like. And I think... If you go away from here with some sort of sense of excitement, and the word that came out many times today, wonder at how the world works, not only within our areas of certainty, but pushing out into the sort of limits, sometimes uncomfortable areas of uncertainty. That's where the excitement is, that's where the wonder is, and that's where the challenge for the good life is, if you like. So is this the end of it? Well, it is for now. There'll be another Festival of Ideas in 2011. One of the great things about Adelaide that between now and then, there'll be lots of other events on that will stimulate your mind. And we know that people in Adelaide come out to these sort of events in your droves, which is really wonderful. But it doesn't happen by itself. And on behalf of the organising committee, of which I've been fortunate to be a part of this year, first we have to thank all of the speakers who have contributed, which has been wonderful. Many of them have done multiple sessions, like Antonio and Simon, for example, here. I'd also like to thank all the support staff who have been here working, keeping us all going. Not least of which, you're working the sound. The sound quality has been excellent. We've been... A lot of the sessions have been recorded for broadcast or for television on various channels. They're keeping us to time. You don't know what goes on behind this curtain here, keeping us all to time. And Tracy Stanford happened to be around town, what sessions we happened in. That's all been great. Also, I thank Imprint Books for, I don't know if you've been out to the book tent, they have a wonderful array of books. Some things I've been looking for ages, they actually managed to get in, which has been great in supporting the work of the authors, the publications of the contributors. And then finally, behind the scenes, there's Rose White and Lynn Wagstaff, who are in the office, which gets all this stuff going. And the work they do, a little office in town, is absolutely outstanding. And Robert Fidian, who's chairing another session, who's chair of the advisory committee, which keeps this whole thing going, is really great. And finally, it's you guys. It's the audience. And three cheers for the audience, because if you people don't come, we got nothing. And the fact that every session, bad weather, maybe it's, someone said, I've overheard someone say, you have to be mad to stay in bed and miss out on this sort of stuff, even if it is raining. I thought, what a wonderful comment. And we're not mad, because we're all here. And so thank you very much from everybody. And we'll see you again in 2 years.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.